essentially Carlson's duality proof of the interpolation theorem. And we'll prove a little bit more. We'll basically give the strongest statement we can for the disk for H2. So let's recall that H2 is a set of F which are holomorphic in the unit disk, with square summable coefficients. Like that. And we proved some equivalent formulations. It's also the set of F holomorphic in the disk, such that if you take the soup over circles of radius r less than 1, this, and you just take the soup over T F sub RZ squared, well, I'll just put T theta. Okay, so F sub R, when I use it, it simply means this. And of course, I guess the notation here is a little bit confusing. The d theta means that the z is e to the I theta. Okay. And if I put square roots on this, this is the same as equal to this. And we also noticed that we could write it as b a half to the Bessel-Sobel space, one derivative in L2 with the weight, with the right weight. So and the other decision I made was I'm not going to try to prove to you that I can do all this without looking at the notes, because I make mistakes. So we're going to look at the notes as I go. There's lots of mistakes in the notes that you already have that are printed out there. They'll be fixed as we go today. Okay. Oh, and I also wanted to mention now one more thing. We can also view H2 as H2T. This is simply the set of Fourier series with non-negative coefficients. And in fact, we will generally write this function, which is defined almost everywhere as an L2 function on the circle, but it's a special L2 function, doesn't have any negative Fourier coefficients. The ans are the same as these. So we just associate to a power series like this, we just associate formally, you replace z by e to the I n theta, you get an L2 function. And in fact, it's easy to see that you get formulas like f of z, it's 1 over 2 pi I times the integral over the boundary of f star ei theta d ei theta over ei theta minus z. That's Cauchy's formula. Okay. What, of course, is true is if f is a polynomial, then this is literally true. And you just then do a limiting argument using the fact that the convergence by this thing over here, the convergence will be an L2 on the circles. This function is an L2 as a function of theta. So the convergence is easy. So you get this formula in general. And, of course, it can be written out as if you work all this out and you take the ei to theta down, you get this is equal to 1 over 2 pi the integral over t of f star ei theta integrated against 1 over 1 minus, you know, minus i e to the minus I theta z d theta. So this is the inner product of F star and this thing, which is obviously an L2 function, a nice bounded function, and this we call, if I introduce K of, let's say, W z, it'll be 1 over 1 minus W bar z, then the F of z is equal to, what's the inner product, this being the usual inner product in L2 of the circle, is the inner product of F. I'm going to start writing F star as just F, because it's 1 to 1. F against K z. Yeah, so I got the, probably should have written the W and Z the other way around. How about like this? So that's, I can't think on my feet. So the Z has to be barred. I think that's right. Because if we put this in here, the inner product has a bar in it, right? So that's equal to that. The L2 inner product has a bar on the right factor. And the bar puts this to e to the I, e to the minus I theta in Z. So KZ is called the reproducing kernel because it reproduces the function F inside. Of course, you can also get the existence of these reproducing kernels by just abstract Weiss representation theorem for Hilbert spaces. That's a subject for the functional analysis that we will do on Thursdays eventually. We'll do it fairly rapidly. I think it's pretty easy. Okay, and now with this. And the norm of this, I think I should put on the board. Note that the norm of KZ and H2 squared is, of course, KZ, KZ, and by the reproducing property, KZ of Z, is that. So what does this tell us? This tells us that the following map that sends F in H2 to what set of sequences? The set F, let Z be a sequence of points in D. So here we have our set of points Z. They're going to be without limit point. And if we look at the map that takes F to the restriction of F at ZJ, but multiplied by 1 minus ZJ squared root, this particular map takes H2 into bounded sequences. Because it's just trivial stuff. Since what is that? Well, if you apply it's of course F KZ and that's equal to or less than the H2 norm of F and the H2 norm of KZ, and this, but these two guys are, whoops, ZJ. ZJ. These two guys are product one, right? I mean, that's what we did. We simply put a weight here to kill the norm of the evaluation functional, the linear functional that takes F to its value at ZJ is a continuous linear functional on H2, has this norm squared. So you just divide by the norm, and of course it maps into little L infinity. We can write this. So let d mu of z be the measure. This is of course just basic 1 minus zj squared is basically distance to the boundary, right? 1 minus mod zj would be distance to the boundary. This only differs by a factor of 1 plus mod zj, which is between 1 and 2. So it's basically 1 distance to the boundary. And let's look at that measure, which is given by taking the point mass at ZJ and multiplying it, weighting it by this thing. Because after all, what we're going to ask now is when is this thing into L2? Then the above map goes into L2. I'm talking about this map. I'm not giving it a name because we're going to name something else instead. This map will be in L2 is the same thing as saying, I mean, if you have to square them and add them up, but so it's the same thing as saying that this map FZJ, which is the restriction of F to the sequence, lives in the weighted L2 space where the weight is this thing squared. That's why the weight. So the above map goes into L2 if and only if the sequence F is ZJ, J equals 1 to infinity, is contained in the weighted L2 mu space. Right? Because this thing being in little L2 is exactly the same as saying the F squared times the weight is. Well, it's a sequence space. So I like to use little L2 for sequences, right? These are sequences on the natural numbers. I use capital L2 for measure spaces that are uncountable in number of points. Otherwise, I'll get confused. So I'll leave it as little L2 when it's a sequence space. This is, of course, also, this is the sequence space with counting measure. No weight. That's the weight. So let's give this thing a name. Let's call it RF. It's the restriction map. T. The above map T. So I claimed already that it does go into L infinity for sure. So T takes H2 functions into bounded sequences. And we're actually going to be interested in when it takes the into square summable sequences instead. Square summable sequences, of course, are a smaller class. Right? Bounded sequences are the biggest class. So this is a restriction. This is for free. You always get mapping into L infinity. It turns out we're going to be interested in knowing when you actually map into square summable sequence, which is a stronger condition. It will turn out to be equivalent to everything else under the sun. That's why I'm introducing this. So I'm going to put together Cartlesson's theorem with Shapiro-Shields theorem and do everything at once. Yeah, here's a square root. No, it's square root. Here, thank you. Because this is one.
Yeah, it was squaring it. I didn't realize it was going to square.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was a mistake, and you didn't know where the mistake was, right? That's always the case, yes. It was here. Thank you. So R is the restriction map. From F in H2 to Z. You just restrict F to the value. So you get a sequence of values. Okay, so now we have the restriction map. I guess at this point, I'd actually like to do something before we get to the main theorem, of course, which is doing something. But to prepare for this, if the target space, L2 mu, is contained in the range of the restriction map, what does this mean? This just means that every square summable sequence of this form, or a square summable sequence here with respect to the weight, it's the same thing, for every such sequence, there exists an F in H2 that interpolates those values, takes those values, interpolates them to the rest of the disk as an H2 holomorphic function. It does not imply that R of H2 is contained in there. Just the other way. It could go beyond. It just means that this space is at least obtainable. So if this is contained in here, then the closed graph theorem Here's the situation. So we have L2 mu. Okay. Your confusion is because I'm switching from the map T to the map R. So T maps into L infinity. So we're not assuming the other way. Just if it goes in. So the closed graph theorem is, of course, something we'll do on a Thursday. So at the moment, you just have to accept the statement of it. The statement of it will come when we need it. You'll see. It's a very simple theorem. It says you have, under certain conditions, if you have a map, if its graph is closed, then the map had to be continuous. That's the statement of the theorem. The simplest possible case in the world would be if you have a map from a compact space into something, maybe Hausdorff space, I'm just guessing, then in fact F is continuous if and only if its graph is closed. That's just elementary topology. The one that we use here is a little more complicated. So T is defined, well, for us it will be on a Banach space, so that's the completeness is the important part. Yeah, we're not going to apply the closed graph theorem to this. Wait to see how we do it. Apply it to the inverse.
What is the domain and what is the range? That's my question of R.
Oh.
It goes from H2 to which Banach space?
I said to Z, to sequences. No, just sequences on Z. Arbitrary sequences on Z.
Without any norm?
No, nothing. I mean, the restriction map certainly maps to sequences. And now we're going to have a bunch of theorems about what range we get under certain conditions. But at this point, I don't want to identify. The reason I wrote this over is here you can identify, if you multiply by this, it's easy to see you go into L infinity. So there is something you could say over here. It's the sequences such that when you multiply them by that, they remain bounded. You could say that, but it's a mouthful, and it's not of any real interest. That's why I'm not making a big deal yet of what R maps into, because it's obviously going to depend on Z. I mean, what you get will depend on Z. So maybe what I should have said. We should keep a subscript Z on the R for now. Usually the Z is understood and you drop it, but it's probably best right now to keep the Z on the R. So if L2 mu, this is better. If L2 mu, there's also a Z in here, but I guess I had a Z on the mu. So everything has a subscript Z because there's this there's this Z that I put in as a forethought. I should have made a big deal of it. So we're now fixing a Z, which is infinite, no limit point in the disk. And we were starting with some definitions. This is the stuff that comes from the Shapiro-Shields paper. Okay, if L2 is contained in here, then the closed graph theorem gives the following control. And in fact, the functional analysis, the open map theorem, closed graph theorem, what they always do is they take some sort of algebraic thing and they give you some analysis control, some norm control of some sort. And the control is this. For each sequence zeta in L2 mu, there exists an F sub zeta in H2, so the F depends on the zeta. In fact, we will see that it can be taken to be linear, but I don't need to know that right yet. So there exists an F zeta in H2 such that two things happen. One is that the restriction of this holomorphic map to the sequence Z gives you your sequence, so it interpolates the value zeta. Interpolates means takes them, extends them to an H2 function F, zeta. And secondly, as I said, you're going to have norm control. So you don't have to choose the norm of the H2 function much bigger than the L2 mu norm of zeta. It's less than some constant. Times the L2 mu norm of zeta. So, okay, maybe a picture wouldn't hurt. Here's D. C. So here we have our sequence Z, and we assign values at all these points in such a way that when you square the values and multiply by the distance to the boundary, it sums up. In other words, it's an L2 mu. And you wonder, and then the question we will ask eventually is, when is it possible to extend that function from Z to be defined on all of D as a holomorphic function with a growth condition, that means it's in H2, such that when you restrict under the map R, you get this. So that you're interpolating this function, zeta, you're interpolating it from Z to the whole disk in such a way that the answer is in H2. Yes.
Right?
Yes, that's the point. This is the new point. The point is that from the assumption, we know that there's an F zeta. Maybe there's maybe uncountably many F zetas. What we don't know is that any of them might be as small as zeta. Maybe they have to be chosen huge. And the functional analysis says that we can get away with norm control, which will be, of course, very useful. So the proof. Okay. So the proof is short, but this is one of these proofs that I would never have a hope of getting right if I don't look. So let M be the set of F in H2 that vanish on the set Z. So this is simply the set of all functions which are zero on z. They vanish at the points on z. Each one of these point evaluations we just showed is a continuous linear functional on H2 of norm 1 over 1 minus z squared square root. So each one of these conditions gives you a closed subset. You take infinite intersections, it's closed. So M, it's obviously a subspace too, so is a closed subspace. Yeah, it's the kernel of the restriction map. Defined on H2. So it's a closed subspace of H2. Then H2 is the direct sum of M and the perpendicular space to M. Now in a Hilbert space you can basically pretend it looks like a Euclidean space. I mean, this is the real version. These are complex Hilbert spaces, but the idea is that that's M. M perp, and every element can be uniquely represented as an element of M plus an element of M perp. Right, the intersection is zero, and the span is the whole thing. That we will cover briefly when we do the Thursday stuff, when we get to functional analysis. But for now, I think it's easy to accept that. So the Hilbert space decomposes as this, and let's let P perp denote projection onto M perp. So all that means is, given an element in here, it's uniquely written as a sum of something there and something there, so you just map it to that guy. It's just uniquely defined. It's obviously continuous because of a norm, well, you just use the orthogonality, and it's obviously been norm at most 1. Then, if zeta is an L2 mu, and f zeta, we just choose an arbitrary one, in H2 satisfies R f zeta equals zeta, we actually have something better. We have that R of the projection of F zeta also solves the problem. Okay, and R of P perp applied to F zeta also solves the problem. And that's just obvious from the definitions. If this is the point F zeta, then of course here is the P perp of F zeta, and there's the difference. Of course it lies in the other space. I'll just call it P, even though I haven't introduced P. You only need it now. Because P of F zeta, given that it's an M, it vanishes. By definition, at all the ZJs, you have no choice, but this guy must take the same values zeta does there. And of course, you can imagine just from looking at the picture, this obviously is the one of minimal norm that does it, but let's just state that correctly. Then this equals that. And P perp F zeta is the unique such element in M perp. That's because if you have two different elements in M perp that agree on this set, then their difference is in M, and then because M intersection M perp, so the difference is zero. So there's a unique such element in M perp, and that's it. And so now we can actually define a map. So define lambda of zeta equals P perp f of zeta. This is now well defined or zeta in L2 mu lambda maps L2 mu into M perp. And in fact, and R of lambda zeta equals zeta, so R of lambda is the identity, so it's on to. And lambda is on to M perp. Sorry, it's not onto M perp, but the wrong theorem. It's just that. So it satisfies that condition. And now, you know, I was about to apply the open mapping theorem. It does not apply here. It's not an open map. It's the closed graph theorem, as advertised. So we now claim that it says clearly lambda has closed graph, and then there's a bunch of stuff. So we now claim graph lambda is closed. Okay, so let's see how to do that. It's all just definition chasing, essentially, at this point. And then after we show that the graph is closed by definition chasing, then we apply the closed graph theorem, which has some meat to it, and we deduce that lambda is continuous, which up until now we haven't known. So, what do we do for this? So, you pick a point if zeta, say, upper k, and then you look at lambda, upper k. So that's a point in the graph. It is in, of course, L2 mu cross M perp. So that's the metric space. All we need at this point is a metric space. This is a metric space in which this thing is living. And if it tends, so if that tends to zeta h in the space in which the graph lives, that's this thing, as k goes to infinity, well, of course, what do we want to show? To show that the graph is closed, you have to show that any limit point, zeta h, of the graph, this is in a metric space, so it's enough to do sequences, we have to show that this is in the graph. In other words, what we want to show is that h is equal to lambda of zeta. Right? So the idea is that you pick a bunch of points in the graph, and they tend to something. Well, you have to show that the something is in the graph. So, and then we'll know it's continuous by the closed graph theorem. So what do we do from this simple assumption? Well, you have something about zeta, k is going to zeta, and you have these functions, lambda zeta k going to the function h. So you just write down the two things. So zeta k goes to zeta, which means that in particular, for each component, right, these are sequences, and so for each component, it goes component-wise, convergence in L2 mu, because the mu is positive everywhere, it converges point-wise, and the one for the functions is the lambda zeta k goes to h, i.e., in particular, not i.e., which implies, this is also implies, which implies that lambda zeta k zj tends to h of zj. That's because the point evaluation linear function was continuous. And this here is continuous in M perp. I don't know where M perp went. Up there. Yeah, here, in M perp. So we have these two statements. And I now claim that from these two statements and the uniqueness, we said it somewhere up there, the uniqueness of the lambda in M perp, we will get H equals lambda zeta. So incidentally, I only intend to go through this type of argument once, right? We will use the closed graph theorem many times. I'm doing this one in complete detail, and then every other time we'll just say by the closed graph theorem. But I thought it's useful to do it once in complete detail, see how it goes. This is one of... I don't claim that these proofs are the shortest ones possible, but for me, this is one that looked a little bit more intricate than some. So this is about as difficult as it gets in my experience, although maybe I'm missing something and it is simpler than this. That's always possible. Okay, so where are we? So we have these two things for each fixed k. Right, the j's go along. Okay, now... For each fixed j. Thank you. For each fixed j, yeah. This is as k goes to infinity. For each fixed j. Okay. However, now we have lambda of zeta k of zj equals. Let me copy this out and then see why it's true. This is the part where I get confused if I try to do it on my own. F of zeta k j. Okay. Lambda of zeta k. By the definition of lambda zeta k, it's lambda zeta k, by that definition up there, is, without the r, is p perp f zeta k. And then if I want to evaluate it at zj, that's just taking r, which is the sequence you get, and then taking the jth component. So it's a mumbo jumbo, but it's the same thing. And this one is because p perp of f zeta k reproduces. I said it somewhere. R of lambda zeta equals zeta. So this takes you back to the zeta. So we have that equality just because of the definition of lambda and that these things were in the graph. And that happens, implies that h of zj equals zeta j, which I claim is lambda zeta zj for all j. And you get this by taking the limit. As k goes to infinity, this guy goes to hzj, and the zeta kj's go to zeta j. So this goes to that, this goes to that. But by definition of being on the graph, zeta j is lambda zeta at zj. And that implies that h minus lambda zeta vanishes on z. H minus lambda zeta vanishes on z. So it's actually in m. But it's also, of course, in m perp, because lambda takes its values in m perp, and h is in m perp. So that's the closed graph. So that implies h is lambda z, and the point zeta h is in the graph. Lambda. So we have shown, we take an arbitrary sequence in the graph of lambda, and if it has a limit point, the limit point is also in the graph of lambda. As I said, that's just definition chasing. But now, the closed graph theorem says lambda is continuous. And of course, a continuous map on a linear space is bounded. I mean, it's the same thing. It's continuous, i.e., bounded. And now we can take, to get the conclusion of the lemma, what you, the f zeta you choose is this lambda of zeta. So now, choose f zeta equals lambda of zeta in the conclusion of the lemma. And of course, that choice works. It satisfies this, and it also satisfies this by the boundedness. The fact that a linear map is bounded is precisely says that lambda of zeta satisfies such an inequality. I could have written it, I guess. What it means is lambda zeta in H2 equals or less than a constant zeta L2. Actually, lambda lives in M perp, so I could put M perp there, but it's the same norm as in H2. So that proves the lemma. Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, and it satisfies this inequality. And in fact, it's even linear. I didn't say that here because I don't think we need it. But let's just file it away for future reference that you can choose the interpolating function linearly. Sometimes it's not so easy to choose it linearly. Or at least with some control. Better than that. Okay, that's the lemma. Now we can state the theorem. Of Carlson and Shapiro, well, with the added stuff of Shapiro and Shields to it. So here's the theorem. Oh, one other point I wanted to make. We're not quite ready there yet. From this control, I want to deduce that Z has to be separated. So from the control in the lemma, we can deduce the sequence Z must be separated in the hyperbolic metric. Well, that's fancy words, but the actual thing is very simple in the hyperbolic metric. So what do I mean by this? Well, it turns out that for us, it's just this. Well, first of all, separated in a metric means that the distance between any two points must be at least some positive c, fixed, right? And for us, it means that if we have a zi and a zj, that the Euclidean distance between them is at least a small multiple c of the bigger distance to the boundary. I'll just write it out, and I'll make sure I get it right. Minimum distance to the boundary. So there exists a c positive such that the Euclidean distance is vi minus vj equal to or greater than c times the minimum of 1 minus vi, 1 minus vj. So, I mean, other vj's could be out here, for example. They're very separated. So if I fix the zi, you know, the zj would have to be there. So the zj's can be, they can't be, what they can't be is if there's zi, if you look at a little box around zi, say of side length c, times the distance to the boundary, where c is less than 1, then you can have at most one point in each box. That's what we're going to get. We're going to get this statement out of this statement. Yeah. Yeah. As you'll see, what we end up proving is will involve the actual hyperbolic metric or the exponential of it. I always get confused, but let's just do the proof and then we'll see. But this is, I think, is the simplest way to see it because this is the way you imagine things. One box, one point per box, for small enough uniform boxes. And the boxes look like this. Almost 1 point per box. And not close on the edge either. I mean, okay. So here's the proof. So we have to remember the lemma. So in other words, ultimately what we're interested in here is if the restriction of H2 onto the sequence contains all of L2 mu, then the sequence must be separated. And the proof goes, so choose F in H2 with F of ZJ, fix F in H2, fix I, choose F with this equals delta IJ. In other words, 1 at VI, 0 at 0 elsewhere. Certainly, that can be done by statement 1 that says that the restriction of H2 is onto, because this certainly is a sequence in L2 mu. And what's its norm? Well, we can apparently choose the F in H2 with norm at most that thing, the delta IJ in little L2 mu. The I is fixed, so I guess it's delta I. And so what is that? That's just going to be the square root of 1 minus ZI squared. Right? That's the control. Then, for a J not equal to I want to show that the points are separated, and it's just a little quadratic minimizing argument. For J not equal to I and any complex scalar lambda, we get, so this is like the proof of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, so you get 1 is equal to what? F at VJ minus anything times, or have I got this the wrong way around? Okay. That means that in the proof I have written here, I have to interchange I's and J's all the way through. F at ZI is 1. And this, because J is not equal to I, F is 0. So I can add anything I want to that. And this is always true, even if I square it. And what is this in terms of the inside of the square is K ZJ minus lambda KZI. Right? That's just this is the linear functional, which is inner product with KZI. As I said, I have to everywhere interchange I and J in my argument here. You get this. And now you just write this out using that we know what the K looks like. Actually, we don't just yet need to know it. And we need to. So if you write this thing out, after you apply Cauchy-Schwarz first. And so this is equal to or less than F H2 squared. And then here, you're going to get, well, I'll write it. It's the norm of KZJ minus lambda, or KZI, lambda KZJ squared. Well, that's equal to or less than some constant, zeta L2 mu. And then this guy is, what is the L2 mu? It's that thing. So if I square it, it's, I can actually write it, work it out, it's 1 minus ZI squared, that thing, times then this. For this, we'll write this out as KZJ in H2 squared. This, of course, is the H2 norm. These are H2 functions, the reproducing kernels. So you just expand this out, and because it's a Hilbert space, and you just expand it out in the inner products, you get this thing plus the other term at the other end is mod lambda squared times, oh, that's I. This is KZJ. And then the one inside will be minus twice the real part of KZI, KZJ. Sorry, there's a lambda squared. There's a lambda.
Inside the real part.
Thank you. actually, I guess it comes out as a lambda bar, right? Because it came out of the second term. It's a lambda bar. So, oh, I read from what I erased. It's the norm of F. The norm of F is equal to or less than that thing up there, the norm of the delta function, and that's equal to or less than that. If I square it, I get that. So it's the norm thing. And now I want to write this as just rewriting it a little bit. So it's KZI over ZI. That's this thing. Because remember, KZI at ZI is the reciprocal of that. So that's this part. And then this will be KZJ at ZJ. That's this part. Plus lambda squared. Oh, this is I's, of course, now. I's. And this is the KZI, I'm sorry, KZJ, ZJ minus twice the real part of lambda bar, and this is the reproducing kernel, so this will be KZI at ZJ. That's the reproducing kernel. So we get all that, and now you choose an appropriate, now you choose lambda to minimize the expression on the right, and you get what you want after a little bit of fussing. So maybe at this point, rather than write it all out, because after all it is, okay, so we choose lambda to minimize the expression. So you can guess what it is or you can look it up. And you know what? I'm gonna put it in anyways. So it's K Z whatever. What did I write over there? KZI is ZJ. Well, ZJ, ZI is the same thing. It's the same modulus. It doesn't really matter which way you do it. The root of KZI, ZI over KZI, ZJ. J, Z, I, and then the root of K, Z, I, J. And if we choose that, we get the following thing I claim, a constant times 2 minus 2 times the modulus K, Z, J, ZI over the square roots. So we get that symmetric expression. Down here. So if we choose the lambda, we end up getting 1 equal to or less than that. Because with this choice of lambda, we get this expression. Okay, and the reason I wrote it out was because there's still just a little bit of trickery. As I said, this is really the hardest of all of, even the separation implications, this is the one that's the most technical. In detail. Now we use the following identity. Zi minus Zj over okay, this thing, I guess if I wrote it out the other way, J and I. This thing, of course, is what I called the other day phi zj at zi. It's this thing in there. Right, this is the automorphism of the disk that interchanges 0 and zj. So it's 1 minus the mod squared of that thing. I'm not going to do the arithmetic because I'll get it wrong. It is definitely this. You multiply on the top by the two distances to the boundary and underneath by the square of the kernel. That thing, which is equal to k zj zi squared over k zi zi k zj zj. Okay, so if we put that in there, it should now be obvious that this thing is equal to or less than 1 minus 1 over 2c squared. Okay, this shouldn't be hard. Oh, this is an identity. I'll just put identity, meaning you're not supposed to know that that's true just by glancing at it. You expand everything out and cancel stuff, and it works out to that. If you've never done it, you should do it once in your life. I mean, this identity extends even to the ball in CN, where now, of course, these are maps from the ball to the ball, the involutive automorphisms. The same formula holds, so it's a very, very useful identity. And the reason that's true, I think, is because if you divide by the C and the 2, and then take away the 1, take that over and square it, that's it. So what does this say? Finally, we get that this expression is equal to or greater than some positive constant. I and J are not equal. Finally, you get this thing, zj minus zi over 1 minus zj bar zi equal to or greater than c, some little c positive for all I not equal to j. And the little c, of course, comes from you take 1 minus that square root. So anyways, you get this uniform lower bound. This is directly related to the hyperbolic metric by some formula, and I didn't look it up, so I don't know what it is, but it's definitely. And you can now see at a glance that this condition, well, not a glance, just sit and play with it a bit, you can easily see that that condition is equivalent to the condition I gave you before about this Euclidean distance being equal to or greater than some multiple of the minimum of those two. And so they're the same. So that's the separation. It's in the notes. I don't want to take time. I wanted to state the theorem before we took a break, and I'm going a little over. Exercise show that if the restriction of bounded analytic functions equals little L infinity, now this is unweighted counting measure, oh well, it's L infinity, so it's just sequences that are bounded. And here the restriction that we put in here is of course equal, because obviously if you restrict a bounded analytic function, you're contained in L infinity. So the condition that this contains little L infinity is equivalent to its equal. So there's no question of into here. There was in the previous one. Exercise, show that if this interpolation is onto, remember before what we had was little L2 of mu contained in R8, two. Now we have little L infinity contained in RH infinity, i.e., little L infinity contained in RH infinity. They're equivalent because R is obviously into. So this is, once again, it's the same phenomenon there, except it's the infinity version of the L2 version there. So that if that happens, then Z is separated. And it's just a couple of lines using the open mapping theorem. This time, of course, R is obviously a bounded map. It's norm 1. It's onto. By the open mapping theorem, it's an open map. That means that there's a small ball around here such that R of the unit ball maps onto that. And then from that, it's easy to do stuff like this and get this condition. Actually, it's using the Schwartz lemma from complex analysis. I'll just let you read it because we're running out of time. It's very elementary. It's easier than the one we just went through. So that uses open map theorem and the Schwartz lemma. You know, the Schwartz lemma, if you have a holomorphic function mapping the disk to itself and 0 to 0, then f of z in modulus is equal to less than mod z. And that's exactly what you use to get this thing after you unravel it. Okay. So here's the theorem. I can finally state it. The reason I had to get those two necessity statements about separation is that I just wanted to state the theorem for separated sequences. So suppose Z is separated. Notice that this is necessary for L infinity contained in or for L2 mu contained in RH2. Those are the two interpolation problems that we're interested in Carlson's theorem. So suppose Z is separated. Here's the theorem. So the following are equivalent. Five statements, and they're all the same. So one says that R maps H infinity onto little L infinity. Second statement says that L2 mu is contained in R of H2. So notice the change. Here it's bounded analytic functions. Here it's just the Hardy space H2. Third condition is that the restriction of H2 functions is contained in L2. So if you believe the theorem, you now see that either one of these containments implies equality. So in other words, L2 mu contained in there is actually equivalent to equality, and so is the opposite. The fourth one is this Carlson measure condition. As always, we'll put mu sub z equal to the sum of 1 minus zj squared times the delta zj. That's the measure that you associate to the sequence with the weighting appropriate for the H2 space. Condition four is that mu z on a tent above an arc is equal to or less than a constant multiple of the Lebesgue measure of the arc. Let's just draw the picture again. So we have some arc, I, then the tent sitting above it. Well, you just take the equilateral triangle, if you like, formed by those three points. Call that the tent. It can be any convex region that's reasonable that attaches itself to that arc. So it just says that the amount of mass of mu, that is, you sum up the points in here, their distances to the boundary, that should not exceed the total length of the green thing. Oh, okay. So if you want a rigorous definition, you take an arc, on the circle. The arc has two endpoints. Well, at least for small enough arcs, this is a definition. Maybe not for ones that come almost all the way around. And then just take the these two points and pick a take an equilateral triangle based in here. Pick a point there and take the convex hull, which means no. Oh, no, 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 sorry. The disk. There's zero. Well, let me do a smaller one. There's a point, there's a point. Choose that point so that those three form an equilateral triangle. And there's your... That's it. So equilateral triangle. Or sometimes you use... squares. If you're in the upper half plane, you can do the same thing. And of course, there you obviously will use squares. And the disk gets a little... That's four. What's the fifth condition? This is the one that Carlson actually stated in his theorem. And that's that if you take the nth over all j's and then the product over the i's not equal to j of those things, zi minus zj, 1 minus zj bar, zi. So each of these terms is equal to or greater than little c by the separation condition. We're given that. However, this says an infinite product of such things, doesn't say anything yet, says that an infinite product of such things is equal to or greater than a positive number. And this is some delta positive. So this is what you would think of as a very strong separation. Not only are the points in separate boxes, any given point can't actually be close to too many points because you multiply the separations, they've got to be bounded below. So this is a sort of like a very strong uniform separation condition. And I think the miraculous thing is that all five of these conditions are equivalent. So I'll just make a comment before we take a 10-minute break and then we'll go for another half hour and we'll prove as much of this as we can. The comment I want to make is this. You might wonder, can this theorem be generalized? So, yes, you can generalize it by looking at H2 as a Banach space of holomorphic functions on the unit disk. The H infinity turns out to be the set of holomorphic functions which, when you multiply them by something in anything in here, you stay in there. Those are called the pointwise multipliers of the Banach space. You can show by functional analysis that if it maps in, then it does so with control, and it then is a Banach algebra. So you can take any Banach space of holomorphic functions, such as our Besov-Sobolev spaces we introduced the first day, and they will have multiplier spaces. They're not going to be H infinity anymore. They're going to be contained in, that's a theorem, but they're not going to be H infinity. And you can ask, and there's analogs of these things, and all of these things. Everything gets changed, though. Maybe not this. There's analogs of all these four things, and you can ask whether or not these four things are still equivalent for other situations. I guess the universal conjecture, well, modulo something. First of all, first comment is 1, 3, and 4 typically are. I don't know of any nice counterexamples to that. Lots of open questions, but for the most part, 1, 3, and 4 turn out to be equivalent. You can't often prove it. You can prove it when p equals 2 far more often than you can when p is not 2. But I don't know of any case where they're not equivalent. For 2, however, the story is different. 2 is always necessary, but it's not always sufficient. For example, even the Dirichlet space. We introduced that the first day, a very standard space. For the Dirichlet space, this is no longer sufficient. There's z's much bigger than these for which you get this happening. It's called so that you can interpolate the Dirichlet space for a much wider class of z's than you can interpolate its multiplier algebra. And in fact, this question is still open. It's not solved yet for the Dirichlet space. The rest of it, of course, is, but not that one. So problem 2 is a little bit out of the loop. So basically, 1, 3, 4, and of course 5 in the case of the Hardy space, they're all the same. This one turns out to be the same in the case of the Hardy space just because we have Blaschke products. And we can, you know, we've mentioned that theorem for Thursdays, that if you take a function in H2 and you divide by its Blaschke product, you're still in H2. The Blaschke product corresponding to its zeros. That's one of the big theorems. That theorem tells you that this is sufficient. But you need the full force of that Blaschka product thing. And remember I mentioned that for the Dirichlet space, infinite Blaschka products are never in because the image is infinite measure, infinite area, and that's the norm. So therefore, you can't do that trick for the Dirichlet space, and in fact, it fails. So it's kind of an issue. If, okay, one thing that what Shapiro and Shields did is they did replace the P by 2, sorry, the 2 by P, between strictly between 1 and infinity. This becomes a P. The mu, wherever it is, becomes a slightly different weight, 1 o, I don't remember what, but you work it out from the norm of the point evaluation on the space. And H infinity is still the multiplier space of HP. It's still the same. It is equal to the multiplier space of HP.
Because if, instead of HP we take just LP, then L infinity is not the multiplier space of
HP. No, but that, but then you're out of the world of holomorphic functions, and it's just, yeah, yeah. So this, yeah, this we're talking here about holomorphic spaces of functions all throughout. These, they're very special. Yeah, to compare it. Yeah, yeah, it's very different. Yeah, yeah. For example, the Corona theorem, which is the other thread I want to follow. You know, the fact that H infinity, the fact that the point evaluations are dense in the maximal ideal space of H infinity, there's no corona, that's not true for L infinity. L infinity is horrible. I think Garnett writes in his book that nobody's been able to even write down an explicit element of the maximal ideal space of L infinity. That's what he writes. I can't write one down. So yeah, so this is holomorphic. Things are very different. So we'll take a 10-minute break, and we'll start proving 1, 3, 4, and 5 are equivalent anyways.
Thanks for your patience. I hope this
Oh, no, that's good. They're good questions. No, that's good. It, otherwise, I tend to just go too quick.
I was wondering, what is the exact hyperbolic distance between two points?
Because I don't. Yeah, I can't probably remember it right now.
Just one to obtain it.
Maybe somebody knows.
One house. Well, depending on the normalization, maybe one house or whatever the log of the expression of the mod C minus C K divided.
Well, this thing, right? The automorphism.
Yeah.
Zi at Zj. You take log of it. I just couldn't remember what the connection was.
So, can we use either that or maybe the 1/2?
Yeah, something like this.
That's the hyperbolic.
But having some bound on this is equivalent to having the lower bound on the phi. Yeah, this one does. Yeah, we have to get it right. Maybe this one does too by convex because it's the exponential. I don't know. Forget that. This one does. This one does.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, for example, in the Dirichlet space, there's two notions of Carlson measure, right? There's the actual one, mu is d Carlson, that's the correct one.
Yeah.
There's also mu in what we call simple Carlson.
Okay, so
that's the one box condition, and we know it's not equivalent. So if mu z, so over here, it turns out that this and this are indeed equivalent to this, but now it's instead of this, I'd have to write mu z in d Carlson.
Yeah.
It turns out that if you just have mu z in the weak Carlson space, that one's true. So this holds in much greater generality.
This is equivalent with mu in this
no.
simple?
No. It's the simple condition is sufficient. And in fact, I guess the best result I know of is the one that Rockberg and Arkosy I have, something called the weak simple condition for mu is sufficient, but we don't know necessary and sufficient conditions. It's open.
I see. So
the open question for the Jewish nation is, what are necessary and sufficient conditions?
Yep.
Have L2 mu
contained in. Yeah. Yeah. In other words, just interpolation without saying like strong interpolation or universal interpolation. Okay. This is usually just called interpolation. And that's an open question. It's a, yeah, an interesting one. Also, the zero sets of Dirichlet functions. That's been open a long time. It's kind of related.
Yeah, for sure.
But
then, so this has corona or no corona?
It has no corona, no.
But if you replace just by the Dirichlet space, you need to look at the multipliers on this.
Yeah, that has no corona.
So the corona theorem is
known for that. Is known for that. Zhao gave a proof in 1998. We'll give his proof. Also, everybody refers to Tolokonnikov as having given a proof, but I can't get the paper.
Uh-huh.
Some Russian translation. I know it exists. I just haven't found it yet, but I will. And I don't know. Zhao doesn't say he did it. Others seem to say he did it. So I don't know if Tolokonnikov did it or not. I have to check myself to find out.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay.
People like Trent, I think, and others write that he did do it. But then Zhao wrote a paper in which he cited that paper and never... Yeah, he claimed it as he just left the reader thinking that it was Zhao's theorem. So I don't know.
What did Nikolsky say in his book? Did you?
I haven't been able to.
Nikolsky has this appendix for.
Yeah. I think I might have read that Kolokonnikov has done it there too. I think so. Yeah. Although it's kind of, you see, they have so many different things. You know, they have like the infinite version and
that. Tend to look at the.
Yeah, the functions, the operator stuff more. And so it's often hard to translate. So I don't know yet. But I hope to find out before we get to that point. But yeah, this is an interesting open problem. And it's a very interesting problem.
So necessary sufficient
conditions for that.
Yeah,
it's a very simple interpolation problem for a classical space that's unsolved after all these years. Still.
Organizational question. At what time is my seminar?
Somebody said it was 1 o'clock.
Apparently, I mean, it's fine with me whichever time. But for obvious reasons, I would like to know when it is. Because apparently it's listed 1 o'clock harmonic analysis seminar, 2 o'clock operator theory seminar. So, I mean, it's fine with me whichever, but I can be there at both times. So I'm confused.
Oh, it sounds as if, I don't know, we're probably called the operator theory seminar. So that would be 2 o'clock. And they probably decided to put a harmonic analysis one in because some of the organizers of that have arrived, Isabella and Alex, and they probably said, oh, let's put in a harmonic analysis seminar.
Okay.
Whether or not they have a speaker, is the speaker listed?
For neither of them.
You were supposed to be listed for that.
I
sent it all in time last Thursday.
Quite difficult after 2 hours of lecture to have a seminar at 1 o'clock.
And again at 2.
Yeah, and again at 2. It's
well, for a lot of people, we'll go to everything.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Yeah, technically, it's at 2 because. Technically, it's at 2. Maybe what we should do is go write a note on the blackboard giving your name and the title of your talk at 2 in the operator theory seminar. Would that be better? Because it gives everybody...
I can write it on the board over there. I mean,
is it in this room? Okay. I'll check the web. I'll figure it out.
Actually, I haven't checked the web.
I'll check the web and I'll write something somewhere. I think it would be best if we can do it at 2, I think it would be better because some people might want to rest. I don't think they have anybody for the harmonic analysis seminar yet. They probably just wanted to put it in place because after the conference that's coming up in February, of course, or maybe even before. But I don't have to talk to Alex or Isabella. I did, but they didn't mention that today.
The next one, I don't know if you know my mathematical nephew, I guess, Hans Jacobian.
No, how's the name?
Hans Jacobian. He was a...
Jacobian? Like a Jacobian?
Well, you should ask him. I mean, he was a student of Chris Bishop.
Ah.
He's here as a postdoc in Toronto.
Chris Bishop has a really good paper on this stuff.
Yeah.
Way back with the Marshall Sundberg, and he and... and they vie for the honor of best unpublished paper.
It's not published.
Neither of those papers were ever published, and they're cornerstones of the theory.
So basically, one can get them by.
Don Marshall has his paper on his website, and if you write to Chris Bishop, he'll send you one.
This is Chris Bishop's
student. Hi. How do you do? Yeah. yeah.
So he's willing to give another seminar.
Good. Good. So today at the seminar, we will get people organized for next week. So we'll see then who. We'll see anybody who, you know, is leaving quickly will maybe get preference. And those who stick around longer can wait. Otherwise, we'll get you guys in there.
Sorry, I'm not able to come earlier. I have teaching before.
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
Excuse me, can I ask a question? Huh? So the R maps that goes 18 from 12 to the input, you click. But for H2 goes to L2, is it open? Because
it's like not into. That's the problem.
I feel like when you want to pull open everything source graph, you just repeat the steps, right? You take projection and then.
Yeah.
The proof basically repeats the
open mapping, yes.
Close graph, so to play ahead.
Yeah. But in the case.
It looks too similar to exact right.
No. R of H2 maps out, and here's L2 of mu. It may go beyond L2 mu. Okay. So you can't apply anything to R, because it's not into. But the fact that it contains this. Then you remember what we did? We sort of went backwards, chose the unique projection. We actually got a linear map coming back,
yes.
a one-sided inverse.
You paid for it. Yeah, okay.
And then we applied closed graph to that.
Okay.
We can't apply anything to this because it's not into.
I understand.
Here it's into, so you can use open mapping theorem, into onto. Here, if this was into onto, I would have used open mapping theorem.
Yeah, because it sounds so close, like take project. It sounds so close, like.
But for here, you can't use the open mapping theorem on R because it's not into.
Because it's not into. Basic step of projecting and then
you can do the backwards one, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's a little tricky.
That's why I insisted before about the range, because it's not a range to apply this to R.
No, I had to create a partial inverse, a one-sided inverse. Yeah. Okay, so I guess our 10 minutes is up. So here we have our five conditions. So we're going to start by proving the equivalence of 1, 3, 4, and 5. We'll leave 2 to the end, because as I say, it's more specific. Well, so is 5, I guess, specific to the space, as I said, because 5 uses Blaschka products, too. So we prove 1 implies 5 if and only if 4, if and only if 3 implies 1. Oh, sorry. First, we're just going to show the equivalence of 1, 5, 4, and 3. All proofs not involving 5 will take place in the disk. So of course you should view that with some alarm, because you're saying, well, the theorem is stated about the disk. Why on earth wouldn't we prove it in the disk? And yes, the alarm is that all proofs involving 5, that will be 1, I guess 5 implies 4, and 5 implies 1, and 1 implies 5, they will all be done in the upper half plane, for reasons that I'll now say. So we're going to jump back and forth between the unit disk and the upper half plane. And of course there is a bit of a catch because of the point of infinity, but not much. But let me just say, all proofs involving 5 take place in the upper half plane, which I'll call U. So this is U, this is D. And of course there's a map, the Riemann map, the standard one that takes this onto this. And what does it do? It takes 0 to I, it takes 1 to 0, and it takes minus 1 to infinity. And I don't want to get too far. I guess I'll just do this once, and then I'm going to copy formulas. So if we put, I don't know. One way is easier than the other. So if I want W to be 0 when Z is 1, I want that. If I want W to be infinity when Z is minus 1, I want that. And if I want W to be I when Z is 0, that obviously then is the Riemann map that takes this 1 to 1 onto that. And if you do that, you can, now I'm not going to write anything down, but you can define H1, H2, HP, just as we did for the disk, except that now with straight lines taking the LP norm along here of the holomorphic function, taking the soup as you come down. I don't want to redo all of that stuff here, but you can make that definition and you get the following Blaschke products. Blaschke products in U are given by, so if you now have a sequence of points, zj and u, the point I, of course, corresponds to the origin, is a little special, just like it was before. So the point for, and I'm going to use z over here. Okay, up there I use w, and I'm interchanging w and z. I want to use z for the upper half plane too, just as I do for the disk. I don't want to distinguish, but we use the map. Yeah. In fact, I will list all the things which I'm not going to prove, but that we will. For example, I'll list the Blaschke products. Let me do that first, and then I'll do the Carlson regions. I'm going to list everything that you see in the theorem here and tell you what it is in the upper half plane, the analog of it. There's a catch, though, but that's why I want to discuss this in a little detail before we get going. Blaschke products in U are given by dz equals. Well, so the one for 0, the one at I, so you have some, that'll give you like k zeros at I. Incidentally, they basically all have the following type of form, z minus something over z minus the complex conjugate. Because then when z is real, these have modulus 1, which is the hallmark of a Blaschke product. It's supposed to have modulus 1 on the boundary. Here you go from j equals 1 to infinity, and of course you need the standard convergence factor, which, if you do the Cayley transform, turns out to be this. At this point, you're wondering, why on earth would you come to the upper half plane? It looks worse than the Blaschke product in the disk. But now we're going to use something which I'm just going to assume. I mean, I'm sure it's easy to prove, but I haven't done it. In the case all the ZJs are bounded, so in other words, all the ZJs are contained in some big like this. Some big semicircle. And the reason all the ZJs are bounded. Oh, first of all, I should have said something else. BZ equals this, provided, and what's the Blaschke condition? The Blaschke condition is the sum of YJ over 1 plus ZJ squared. Being finite. That just turns out to be the condition that you get is necessary for the HP functions to have zero sets, and it also allows you to prove that this thing converges uniformly on compact subsets. In the case, however, when all the ZJs are bounded in a disk like this, then of course the Blaschke condition becomes something simpler than the Blaschke condition is J equals 1 to infinity YJ. Oh, incidentally, what's YJ? YJ is the imaginary part of ZJ. So for example, if that's ZJ, I write it as XJ plus IYJ. So that's YJ. YJ is always positive. It's the distance to the boundary. So it looks the same as the other Blaschke condition, kind of, if you wrote the product as a... Oh, it is the same. It's the sum of the distances to the boundary. Is this. And the nice thing is, these factors are not a problem anymore. The arguments are controlled. You can ignore them. Just take them out. Then that condition is that. And the product J equals 1 to infinity, the infinite product, Z minus ZJ over Z minus ZJ bar, converges uniformly on compacta. So the things wiggle a little bit, but not enough, and you get that the infinite product converges anyways.
You mentioned the Cayley transform.
Yeah, the Cayley transform of this thing.
Oh, that's okay.
If you take the Blaschke product on the disk and apply the Cayley transform and manipulate, you get this. This is what you get. And I'm now pointing out that if you're in the upper half plane and you restrict yourself to a bounded collection of zeros, you can dispense with this thing. And you can use this as your Blaschke product. I mean, this is now a bounded analytic function in the upper half plane, has its zeros at precisely the ZJs, and has modulus 1 almost everywhere on the boundary. In other words, you can use this guy instead of the actual one. You can use this one. It still works. Just a slight modification of that one. Still works. I think at this point I'm just going to refer you to John Garnett's book if you want to see a proof of this. But one thing I do want to say is, what does this correspond to on the disk? Well, on the disk... That's the fast enough.
Okay, but in the...
This is distance to the boundary.
This the
general one?
Yeah,
but then you see, you have to worry about what happens to distance at infinity. It gets blown up somehow, and so it has to be... So this is still somehow related to that. Let me just show you... So this region of the semicircle thing, of course, will come over to here, you know, typically something like this. It won't be at, see, minus 1 goes to infinity, so it'll be regions like this. So if you have all your zeros in some thing away from minus 1, that corresponds to this. So we're not covering what happens here, but I'm just going to ignore that, because presumably if you rotate, you can include that in the theory somehow by splitting your zero set up into two pieces, but then you have to worry about how you glue them back. I just don't want to do that. What you can do, and this is actually true, when we're doing the theory with these nice Blaschke products, this is because the geometry is simple. Oh, and also, the tenths, for our purposes, are equivalent to just squares. So this, we can actually use squares here. These things, the geometry is very good with the squares, and we can prove all the technical geometry that we need. That obviously comes into play with condition 5. And condition 5, of course, is just the product of these guys being bounded below. And it's all very simple in the upper half plane. It is possible to take the proof that we'll give in the upper half plane and simply do the same proof back here, but you have to make new estimates that are not so obvious. And the curvature, it just messes you up. So I'm going to do this fairly standard procedure. Most people do it. They work on the upper half plane when they want to use the Blaschke product with condition 5. And otherwise, the disk is fine. So with that caveat, let's start with the proof that 1 implies 5. And I'm now glad that I did not prove earlier that the separation condition is necessary for this. Remember I said you can use the open mapping theorem and get it's necessary using Schwarz lemma? Well, we're going to do something much stronger. We're going to use something much better than the Schwarz lemma. We're going to use Blaschke products, the fact you can divide by them, to get strong separation, which obviously implies separation. This is much stronger. So we're actually going to prove this implies this. But of course, we have to use more heavy machinery that's not available in other situations. The Schwarz lemma is always true, but the Blaschke products don't always live in your space. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You remember I mentioned over here you didn't have to use tens. You could have used things like that, and then they might exactly go over to that. But I don't know. Okay, so for 1 implies 5. Well, the fact that it's on 2, so we're going to let B be the Blaschke product associated to the points in Z. So let B be, and I'll assume that I is not a 0 because it just means I have to write something different. So J equals 1 to infinity. Where Z is equal to those things, and I, let's assume it's not there, because otherwise we have to change the formula, look of it. Then, what can we do? I guess R maps H infinity into L infinity, and here we're quotient out by N is the kernel of R, which of course is the set that we called M before. And of course it's closed. R is continuous because it maps into L infinity continuously. So you mod out by its kernel and you get that we have a one-to-one map into L infinity. So here I'm just using, this is one Banach space. It's the quotient space you get by factoring out another closed subspace. The elements are the cosets, and their norm is the minimal norm of the elements in the coset, stuff like that. Also, by assumption, it's onto. Oh, because we assumed it was. And yes. Okay. Now it's one-to-one. Kernel of M is closed in H2. I think I may have written it wrong in my notes. That's why I was a little bit puzzled about it, too. Yeah, it's wrong in my notes. That's why I couldn't think it through. So R maps this, where, so it's now onto, and it's now one-to-one. And by the open mapping theorem, it will be invertible. Remember, by the open mapping theorem, it was already onto. But now, in fact, since it's an invertible, an onto map that's invertible is obviously continuous. So then R, where it has a continuous inverse by the open mapping theorem. And you see, this is what having R map into the Banach space buys for you. You get this much stronger statement. Whereas before, when R just contained L2 mu but didn't map into it, we had to work harder with the closed graph theorem coming back. And I think we're going to let MZ be the norm of this thing. Oh, yeah, that's because H infinity is bounded with norm 1 into L infinity, because the, so F of ZJ, that's the soup of the FJs. F of ZJ, of course, that's equal to or less than L infinity norm. So it's bounded with norm 1, yeah. So let MZ equal the norm of the inverse. Subset of H infinity. Thank you. H infinity. And again, it's just because the point evaluations, after all, H infinity, if you like, is contained in there's F, E, I, theta, and then you have the kernel 1 over 1 minus e to the minus I, theta, Z. So you still have this representation, because after all, F is an L2, it's an H2, it's an H infinity. H2 is a bigger space. But now you notice that if you just take the absolute value, this kernel is an L1. I mean, Z is not at the boundary, so this is an L1 function. So you certainly see that it's a continuous linear functional, and therefore you get closed. And you take the intersection of them, and Z be the norm of the inverse map. And now, we do the trick with the Blaschke product. So, if Fj and H infinity, solves Fj Zi equals delta Ij, so once again, it's the function that's 1 at the point Zj, 0 at all the zi's. And, of course, the norm of Fj in H infinity is equal to or less than Mz. That's because this guy has norm 1 in L infinity. And the norm of the inverse map is Mz. Then, it's very simple. We just consider GJ, then let GJZ be FJZ, divide out all the zeros of, not all the zeros, all of them except ZJ. So you write this where, what is BJ? Capital BJ is the infinite product, but you don't include J. Z minus Zi. So it's the original, wherever I wrote it, the original Blaschke product, but you leave out the factor involving Zj, because after all, Fj is 1 there. You don't want to make a pole. But you divide out all the other ones. And then by that theorem that we will prove this Thursday, the H infinity norm of Gj is the same as that of Fj. Because after all, the Blaschke product is 1 almost everywhere in the boundary, and a little limiting argument will prove that statement that I just made. So then, No. Yes, that's because the inverse map has norm mz. So since this guy, since the target has norm 1, and the inverse map, which takes us to fj, in that quotient space, and then we just simply pick a representative. We get that bound for it. So then what do we have?
We have to add some epsilon or something. Okay. Just to make sure that
I'm... Possibly. I don't know enough to, off the hand to think about it. That's related to the question that does the infimum exist. You're right. And here I'm sure it does, but it doesn't always. So let's just ignore that problem by putting the epsilon in. And then, after all, we're just trying to get this condition with a delta. I'm not trying to get the sharp delta, but anyways. So then what do we get? Gj in H infinity norm is in fact equal to Fj, which is equal to or less than Mz plus epsilon, implies, and now you just evaluate it at Zi. At Zj, you get this over Bj, Zj. That's, of course, 1 over Bj at Zj. If you take the absolute values, that's Gj at Zj. And, of course, that's equal to or less than the H infinity norm of G, and that's equal to or less than Mz plus epsilon. So what you get out of this is that Bj, Vj is equal to or greater than 1 over Mz plus epsilon for all epsilon positive, means that we actually get Bj, Vj equal to or greater than that. This is what we define as the delta. Because what's the condition? I hope it's still here. Yeah, it's the infimum over J, and what is this thing in here? This is precisely Bj at Zj. You can take the absolute values in or out of the product. It's the Blaschke product of all the terms except the jth one. So we end up getting that the inf of that. So anyway, delta works in condition 5. And in particular, it's separated the sequence. Okay, so we've run out of time. Next time we'll continue with this proof. 5 implies 4, implies 3, implies 4 and 5 and 1, and then we'll include condition 2 at the end. So both of these conditions, 5 and 2, use this very strong property that you can divide out by Blaschke products. And this is very special because, as I said, the Dirichlet space does not have infinite Blaschke products. It's not available there. And in fact, this equivalence fails for the Dirichlet space. In higher dimensions, you don't have Blaschke products. And that's a problem. There are some substitutes kind of looking like Blaschke products, but we'll talk about that when we get there. Okay, so this Thursday we'll go back and finish the HP theory. I think we'll get it completely done. And then next Tuesday we'll finish this proof, and then next Thursday we can start the functional analysis, closed graph theorem, open mapping theorem, and all that. And the week after that, then we'll start Peter Jones's constructive proof, which is very useful. Also tied to the disk so far, but very, very useful theorem, and it's got a very beautiful step in it, which may be due to some of the Russians. Anyways, we'll find out when we get there. But it's a very beautiful proof. And then we'll get to the corona problem after that, and then on to higher dimensions, and see where it goes. Okay.